before I start, maybe I'll just explain why evolution. I will be talking about the history of the human rights conditionality in the EU, how it came about to be, what is the process today, and make certain links to what was before and what is now, and how I see process of human rights conditionality today, and maybe some room of improvement. So this is a brief outline. I will be speaking about these three points. So first one is security concerns, human rights, minority rights, the sort of connection that goes through the history, which I will explain shortly after. The second point will be the power of EU human rights conditionality. What is the EU doing better? So EU is being much more convincing in making sure certain states that are on the road to become members comply with the conditions, unlike, for instance, Council of Europe or other organizations that apply same human rights conditionality. So I'm going to be looking at how European Union is doing that process better and what's the trick. And last, I'll just briefly talk about the room for improvement. Is there room for improvement today, and what can we actually learn from all these three points? So I will move to my first point, which is a historical overview. While looking at how European Union started and why human rights became important, is because I want to show how today there are certain issues that pop up the same way when it comes to human rights. For instance, before talking about the European Union enlargement, I would like to start with maybe talking about the process of European Union signing trade agreements with other countries. So it was in the late 70s. At that stage, it was believed not just by the European Union, but by other organizations, that giving aid would make human rights more applicable in other countries. But afterwards, after the US Congress, they were like, okay, giving aid doesn't make sure that human rights are applied in the countries, but actually we should maybe condition aid to first human rights. And that sort of a switch at the US Congress pulled out the whole other organizations, not just European Union, so World Trade Organizations, everybody started doing it and putting in a human rights clause. So for instance, in the European Union, we have the Long Convention, the first one, in 1975, which does not have any human rights condition. However, afterwards, there were conflicts, for instance, in Uganda and other African countries, and they were like, okay, well, maybe we should consider financial aid and human rights, how we can condition financial aid with human rights. And they made a little memorandum, and unfortunately, that's when the thing stopped. So it took more than 10 years to the Lome 4 Convention in 1995 to actually put the first human rights clause in a trade agreement. So we see that human rights conditionality went a bit slow. It also went a bit slow when it comes to European Union enlargement. But that's also because the European Union itself transformed to economic community, afterwards to a bigger organization. Before, the first stage was European agreements, and as some of you might know, the only condition for a state to join the European Union was for a state to be just European. That was it. Afterwards, again, in that same period, later 70s, we have, again, security concerns. There were things happening in Spain, things happening in Greece, things happening in Portugal, and they were like, okay, we might need to stop your process of European integrations due to undemocratic situations in your countries. So that's why Spain was rejected at that point, because it was considered undemocratic. Afterwards, after that stage of European agreements, there was a big break when it comes to human rights, and it was a Copenhagen meeting. It was after the European Union transformed into European community, that communities then transformed into European Union. And thus, as the organization grew, it became more concerned with human rights as well. So we have a Copenhagen criteria, which are four criteria, which is stability of democratic institutions, rule of law, human rights, and we have minority rights. I will get back to these minority rights a bit later in the end and how I connect it again to the security concerns that started at the beginning. But after the Copenhagen, there were certain points that needed to be cleared out. So they had conditions, but it wasn't exactly clear what stability of democratic institution was, rule of law, human rights, minority rights. They all needed to be more specific and more defined, and that's how the process went on further after the Copenhagen and the Treaty of Amsterdam, then Nice, then Lisbon, when we have now the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, and European Union now in the process of accessing European Convention on Human Rights. So this is something I talk a bit more in my paper, but for now I just wanted to mention it. What happened with Copenhagen criteria, which is really interesting, is the point of minority rights. It was during the 90s, and some authors believe, and so do I, that it actually came out as there were concerns about ethnic tensions in Eastern and Central Europe. And that is sort of true, because if we look at what happened at that period during the 90s in the Balkans and the wars and the ethnic conflicts, ethnic cleansing and everything, those concerns became, unfortunately, true and ended up in a war in Bosnia, Croatia, and other countries. What I'm putting here as a link is, again, that minority rights are, again, being used in the countries that are on the way to EU, the Southeastern European countries. They have problems with ethnic conflicts, and are again being used as some sort of security concerns. So we have still here today, again, security concerns as top priority for considering human rights. And I don't believe that is enough to be done, and I believe that there needs to be a more proactive approach, and I might raise that just at the end. This is just a brief chart about the EU and other organizations that are trying to do the same thing, basically, to make human rights conditionality work. Unfortunately, these all were not that successful as the EU. Now we have organizations who were members long ago of the UN, Council of Europe, OSCE, who are now racing to get positive reports from these organizations in order to get a positive report from the European Union. And why is that so? Well, there's three things that I would like to mention. First of all, European Union has managed to leak economic and political conditionality. It has done so best than all these other organizations. Second of all, it has managed to create very specific mechanisms of gatekeeping, benchmarking, and monitoring. So we have these kind of processes and stages into the European Union enlargement process, and the country needs to go through each and every one of them and gets rewarded, so the politics of carrots and sticks. And third, EU has a very strong passive leverage, meaning that the incentives to join the EU comes also from under. For instance, EU has managed in some countries to make disruptions of certain governments. Like, for instance, in Slovakia, during Vladimir Mercer's government, the EU's no meant the fall of his government. Also today, the EU uses conditionality in the states of the Balkans by, for instance, not allowing them to move into the next stage unless they extradite certain war criminals, which has happened with Croatia, which has happened with Serbia. And I believe I don't have that much time. I'm just going to briefly mention, again, I'm not sure why this, well, this is like this, but it mans room for improvement. So These are just maybe a few things I want to scratch in the end of what I see are the rooms for improvement. And first of all, I think I mentioned the need for those conditions to be more specific. Why? Because in the EU reports, you always have this like six-page report saying, 6 pages that goes to human rights. So it goes to international treaties, anti-discrimination legislation, ombudsman institution. It's usually standardized form that they go through. But when talking about certain problems of human rights in countries, they're marked as issues of concern or concern. So you don't see that much of certain solutions and recommendations about what to do next. And I believe that EU human rights conditionality could be a bit more specific when it comes to defining what to do. Why am I saying specific? Because, for instance, having a good anti-discrimination law doesn't mean that everything will work out fine, especially if you copy that law in countries that came from after conflict, are dealing with corruptions, weak institutions. There will be obstacles, and that law won't be able to function. So EU needs to look at other means and policies in order to make those laws work. And second, and I'm bringing it back again to the security concerns which were happening through history and through the development of human rights conditionality, EU needs to be more proactive. It doesn't necessarily have to just react and put out the fires when they come up. So there is a need to look more towards the future and more towards what we can do to prevent things than what we can do to stop things from becoming.